and Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and Jacob's thigh was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. And then he said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then he said, "Your name shall be no more Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Tell me, I pray, your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved." And the sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his thigh. It was night. The man was alone, and he tossed and turned in an uneasy sleep. Something was wrong. Something felt fearful and ominous. The landscape looked like the landscape of a nightmare. And through the darkness, there came a figure. Strange, looming, threatening, drawing near, Jacob turns in his sleep, his conscience troubled, his spirit afraid. He's on his way to meet his brother, and his treachery now is going to be repaid. He thinks he's going to lose his life and all that he has. His conscience is tearing him in two. He feels in his sleep as if the hands of his brother are already upon his throat. And suddenly he awakens, and it's true. There are hands on his throat. He wants to scream out in terror, but he can't make a sound, for the man is choking the life out of him. And then, with all of the muscle and sinew that he had, Jacob began to fight for his very life. He doesn't have any idea what's taking place. They turned and twisted upon the ground, the rocks cutting into his skin. Jacob knows if he does not prevail, he will die. And yet he struggles to see the face of this stranger. Who is it? He thinks at first it's his brother, but it's not. He's never felt such strength before. He's never seen anyone like this before. And on the struggle goes until it is almost morning. And as the first light of dawn begins to appear, for the first time, Jacob feels the stranger cease in his wrestling. And a strange voice says to him, "Let me go now, for it is day." And Jacob realizes that this is no ordinary mortal with whom he has grappled. This is no human strength he has engaged. Jacob realizes that he has been wrestling against the arm of God. "I will not let you go," Jacob says, "unless you bless me. I need your blessing." And the voice again speaks, "What is your name?" Jacob hesitates. I am Jacob. I am who I am. I am a sinner. I am a wily trickster. I have lived by my wits and by my cunning. and I have run for my very life. I am Jacob. But the voice says to him, you shall no more be Jacob, but you shall be Israel, Prince of God, for you have struggled with men and with God, and you have prevailed. The figure rises. The sun is almost up. But Jacob catches him by the cloak and holds on. But wait, you can't leave yet. I must know who you are. What is your name? And suddenly, with a strength he has never felt, the figure set touches him and he releases him. And he says, why do you want to know my name? And in that moment, he is gone. And Jacob reaches down, begins to rub against an aching thigh. For in the fight, his thigh has been put out of place. Jacob stands, but he can't stand evenly. And he begins to walk, but he can't walk levelly. And Jacob begins a limping gait that he will carry to the last days of his life. For Jacob has wrestled with God, and he has been marked by that struggle forever. That is the story. It's an old story. And you and I, in this day and time and place, and you and I who preach to ordinary people, and you and I who only grapple against imagined night enemies, wonder, what on earth does it mean? Now, this is not just a story about Jacob. This is a story about you and me. This is not just a story about one man. This is a story about God's people. And more than that, it is intended to be a story for all people. Jacob was wrestling with reality. What is real? Well, Jacob knew that his two wives and 12 children and the herds of animals were real enough. He knew that Esau was real enough, big, burly, red, mean. He knew that the threat to his life was real enough. But what about these shadowy contacts with God? Were they real? What about that strange God of the desert that had led his people but always seemed to vanish, that never seemed to be possessable, that could not be caught and contained? What about that? What was real? Every human being goes through that struggle. We struggle like Pilate to know what is truth. That is, what is real for me? What are my values? What do I really care about? What do I really construct for myself as the palace of my dwelling? Where will my spirit live? To what will I give my energy and my days, however short or however long? What do I care about? What will I live for? And maybe even intentionally or not, what may I die for? Even as children, we begin the struggle against our parents. And then we wrestle with our friends for mastery and supremacy and honors and positions. And then with our colleagues and with our business endeavors and with all the world, until finally it becomes wrestling with the divine. The ultimate questions that stand behind every man and woman. The ultimate question, what now? On a trip recently, I met a wonderful couple. A man who had retired after teaching at Oregon State all of his life. He taught in the area of science. Our conversations were just pleasant. He found out what I did. He was nominally a member of a church. He was a person of great sincerity and tact, and I could feel caring in his spirit and an understanding about the people in the world who were hurting. We exchanged addresses. Just after Christmas, I got a letter from Fred Fox. Two or three single-spaced typewritten pages. Fred Fox was wrestling with reality. He told about picking up some of the things that I had written and reading through them very carefully. I suspect more carefully than my students read through them. Because he cared. He wanted to know if there was anything real in this or not. Then he began to talk about the presuppositions of science. And in a supplementary page, he began to comment on one of Martin Luther King's sermons, where Martin Luther King had described the kingdom of God in heaven. And he asked in that letter, Fred Fox did, if any of this can be real. And he listed four or five of the basic presuppositions of modern biology and physics. And he said, the end of this is oblivion. Not a pleasant word, Fred wrote, but I find no substitute for it. So, he said, logically and very clearly, this is what I believe. This is what not only I, but many that I have worked with have dedicated our lives to. But the most interesting thing in that whole letter, a letter written by a man who was wrestling with reality, was the very last line, a one paragraph, one line closer. Fred said, where to go from here? And I thought, isn't that an interesting question? To read this letter, you would think everything is decided. To read this letter, you would think all of the conclusions come to a bottom line, and when the sum is drawn, the total is null, zero, nothing, oblivion. But the last line of Fred's letter is, where to go from here? Why, Fred? What is it in your spirit, Fred, in your goodness, Fred, that pulls on you and that bids you ask, where now? Because inside of the human being that is Fred Fox, there is more than simply these external observations of the world order. There is a living soul. And inside of Fred, there is something crying out that says, I want there to be something beyond this. I just don't know what it is. Tell me what reality is. Can this nothingness be the end of it all? Now, not everyone to whom you and I preach will there be such stern observation, such clear, precise logic. But I'll guarantee you that everyone who comes into our churches on Sunday morning comes in just like Jacob. They may not have two wives and 12 children, but they've got plenty of problems enough. They may not own herds of cattle, or they may. They may not have a brother that looks absolutely homicidal, or they may. But they've got their problems too, and they know those problems are real. And they've been wrestling with that kind of reality. And they come into our churches, and then what happens? And there we have to search our own spirits. Do they then find the great reality? Or does somehow that which they encounter seem so unreal that they turn away, or they sigh in frustration and go back out into what they call reality? C.S. Lewis wrote a fascinating little book called The Screwtape Letters, which I'm sure many of you have read. It's funny and it's not funny. It's about an old devil named Screwtape and his young apprentice demon whose name is Wormwood. Wormwood is concerned because the person that has been assigned to him to personally devil has begun to lean toward faith. Wormwood's afraid. He's not real sure he can keep him in unbelief. So he writes to Uncle Screwtape to ask him what to do. And Uncle Screwtape writes back and says, "Don't worry about it. I had a case just like this myself years ago." He said, "There was a certain client assigned to me who was sitting one day in the British Museum. He began to read that spiritual nonsense. And as he read that stuff, he said, he began to get the strangest ideas, and I could feel him beginning to pull away. And I could feel the enemy approaching. But," he said, "in a moment, I had him to close the book, and he went outside and stood there and took a deep breath of automobile fumes. And he listened to the hawking of the newsboys. And he looked around at the crowded, congested traffic. All those things which the mortals call reality. And I knew I had him again." Isn't it strange what we call reality? A nose full of gasoline fumes, the exhaust of automobiles, the screeching of the headlines of the newspaper, the hustling and bustling on the highways, and we call that reality. And yet we need to understand that that is exactly where people are. We may not like it that they're there, but that is where they are. And when they come in, they are not sure that anything we do is real. They do not know if there is a figure, the figure of God, at all or not. And sometimes they are disappointed. Emerson wrote once about a frustrating experience that he had in worship and that he had had for some time. He talked about sitting in a worship service during a snowstorm. And he said the sermon really was so bad he was tempted never to go again. He tried to understand why it was that it was so bad. He liked the person all right. The information he was giving seemed to be accurate enough. What was it? And finally Emerson realized what it was. There were windows behind the preacher, and snow was falling outside. As he looked toward the preacher, he could both see him and he could see the snowflakes falling past the window. And here is what Emerson wrote. The snowstorm was real. The preacher merely spectral. And the eye felt a sad contrast at looking at him and then out the window behind him at the reality of the falling snow. What is wrong with this preacher? Emerson says, he had no word intimating that he had ever laughed or wept, was married or in love, had been commended or cheated or chagrined, if he had ever lived and acted, we were none the wiser for it. That is, the reality of life was not present in the human being who was speaking. The danger, I think, that we face is that because we represent the great authority of God, sometimes through various devices, we will try to increase our authority in ways that God never intended. God does not need us to increase our authority. God's authority is quite adequate. But there are many Baptist preachers who would never think about turning their collars around backwards, who turn their voices around backwards. It's just another way of saying clergy. And really the reason we do that sort of thing is, well, partly because we've heard it done that way, but another reason that we do it sometimes is because we don't want to really sound human. We don't want somebody to think we're just an ordinary somebody. You know what they said to Jesus? Listen, who are you trying to fool? We know who you are. You're not anybody special. You're not any different than we are. We'll tell you who you are. You're the carpenter's son. Now, if Jesus needed to bear the humiliation of the reality of the flesh, of being a living, breathing human being who could weep and who could laugh, who could be called the bridegroom, glutton and wine bibber, who could be rejected because he seemed so real, he was realer than anything anybody ever encountered. But he was also from God. That is where you and I must struggle to hold reality and spiritual truth together. I didn't join the church until I was 14, and I use the term join the church because that is about all I did. I'd grown up in a Baptist Sunday school. I had been badgered and cajoled and urged. I'd had all kinds of games played with my head. I had had ventriloquists with the dummy, and 40 of the kids joined the dummy on the same Sunday. I didn't go down to the front. It isn't that I was so hard-hearted. I really didn't understand what was going on. One of the kids that came by me, I asked him, I said, where are you going? He said, I want to get closer to see the dummy. But I'll guarantee you one thing. They were all dutifully dipped within a week, and they were all members of a Baptist church. I struggled a lot after that, looking at the sky and the stars and trying to understand where in the world God was, where anything could be that I couldn't see. You know, the first time I began to pay any kind of real attention to that, it was not in a Sunday service. And as a teacher of preaching, I hate to say that. But it was when our preacher came down out of the pulpit and came into our intermediate Sunday school class, where I was the last known, unconverted heathen among us. There were a lot of heathen among us, but I was the only unconverted heathen among us. I have heard the superintendent of the intermediate department on more than one occasion say, now we'd like to read our prayer list of the unconverted in our department for the revival. Clyde Fan, let's bow our heads and pray. Well, they were right. I needed it. When the preacher showed up in the opening assembly that morning, he didn't have on his preacher voice. He just talked to us about how he'd been a bad boy and about how he didn't know anything about God and how he couldn't believe anything he heard and how one day he had decided that he would have to give himself to it and find out if it was true or not. And that when he did, he found God to be more than real. Listen, you can't imagine what that did to me. I never had even imagined that our preacher had ever been a boy, much less a bad boy. I sat there like kids do when they're listening to a story. I had my eyes rolled back, and I was just imagining, I was trying to shrink this guy down to boy size and imagine him as a bad boy. And I'll tell you what, it didn't undercut his authority with me at all. For the first time, he became real. And I'll tell you what else, for the first time, the gospel became real. And for the first time, I began to have that funny kind of goose pimply chill that began to say, hey, maybe this is possible. Maybe somehow there is a way God gets a hold of people when you can't get a hold of God. I was wrestling with reality, but the truth is, reality was wrestling with me. For it was God that came and seized Jacob. And it was God that marked Jacob in that struggle. The struggle to hold together that world out there. The world where Internal Revenue sends you letters and where you've got bills to pay. The world where people drive up and down the highways and where there are a million and one little shopping centers. And to hold that together with the things I hear that I cannot see. The preacher will be marked. Layperson will be marked by a peculiar kind of humility. If you know who you are, who are you? God asked Jacob. All right, I'm Jacob. I'm who I am. I am Jacob, the trickster. When we know who we are, reality begins. I was preaching to the Methodists on the West Coast one time, and some of them told me about one of their great preachers of another generation named Wilsey Martin, pastor at Beverly Hills Methodist Church. He was known everywhere out there, and the best preacher on the West Coast. Early one Sunday morning, Wilsey was out in front of his church and saw an elderly woman trying to climb the steep steps up to the sanctuary. And he went over, clad in his ministerial anonymity, and asked, "Ma'am, could I help you up the steps?" She had no idea who he was. She said, "Yes, thank you, young man. I appreciate that." So very, very gingerly, she made her way up the steps, one step at a time, both feet on each step, all the way up to the top, leaning on Wilsey Martin's arm. All the way up there, he was very proud of himself, thinking, "I'm doing this anonymous good deed. She doesn't know who I am, that I'm the preacher of this great church." No doubt he was already thinking about those deeds that are done in secret will be rewarded someday openly. And he was feeling good about that and prepared to go away again in his anonymity. And so he said, as she said to him at the top of the steps, "Young man, do you know who will be in the pulpit this morning?" And he smiled, rather that modest, immodest smile we put on, and he said, "Well, ma'am, Wilsey Martin will be." She said, "Young man, would you mind helping me back down the steps?" Well, there's always somebody out there to help you with your humility, you know. But when we come to know who we are, and then we come to know who God is, we are marked by that. We become the wounded healers. Jesus showed his disciples after his resurrection the marks. The marks were still there. Do you realize that after the resurrection, the marks were still there? The gift, the price. Look, he said. Now that must be true of you and me. Even after the resurrection, even after the wrestling with God, even after the point that we think we have been apprehended, if we have not apprehended, we must still bear the marks that say, I understand. I'm not so far above you nor so far away from where you are that I do not know exactly how you feel and what's happening. So sometimes we will limp. We won't be letter perfect. We will not be able sometimes always to make life come out the way we want it to. But we will be able to reach out to somebody else and say, look, here, touch the hollow of my thigh. Here is where I have been scarred. Here is where I suffered. But here is where God healed. What is your name? What is your name? Jacob said. And so we reach out to God and say, wait, we want to be able to do it. We want to know the formulas and the words to say so that those who come will believe. We want to possess you and catch you and sometimes even use you. What is your name? God said to Jacob, what do you ask my name for? My name's not in question. It's your name that's in question. You will never possess me. I will never be the genie of the jar. You will never be able to rub in some magical incantation in your liturgy and make me come at your bidding. You cannot do that. I am God. I will be free. I am who I am. But I will come to you, and I will grace your words with my word. If anyone love me and keep my commandments, we will come unto him and take up our abode with that person. Who are you, Jacob? You are Israel. You are the one who has walked with God. You are the one who has wrestled with God. More than that, you are the one who has been marked by the truth. I am the way, the truth, and the life. That is enough. That is reality. One of the most striking figures I've ever seen is a statue in London done by an obscure sculptor named Laredo Taft. It's a sculpture of a group of figures taken from a real incident. At the turn of the century, there were poor houses where the indigent were kept. These were primarily people who were mentally handicapped or who were blind or who perhaps were insane. And a group of these people, somehow one cold, snowy winter night in London, got out of the poorhouse and wandered in a little flock together through the streets until they got hopelessly lost. And Laredo Taft has caught that moment as they're all standing slack-jawed, blind-eyed, groping, looking and not seeing, each one turning, looking some different way. They're lost. They don't know where any place called home is. And then you come around to the front of the group of figures. And there you see the figure of a woman. She is blind. She's holding a little child. It's a little girl. She has her hand upon her mother's face, as if in the next moment that smooth stone would turn at the pressure of those tiny fingers. She is smiling, for the little girl is the only one in the group who is both sighted and sane. And she is pointing. There! There, she is saying. There it is. So the God who touched Jacob and the God who touched you and me in Jesus Christ again points out through the child of Bethlehem toward reality. There. There it is, and the cross and the empty tomb. Let's stand together and join in prayer. We could not approach you at this moment, O God, without acknowledging who we are. We are your creatures. We are those who have failed. We are those who have fallen. We are those who have been led to know ourselves, and sometimes it's not altogether a pretty picture. But we bring honor and glory unto you because we have also come to know who you are. And through knowing who you are, we have been given a new name. We are no longer the Jacobs of this world. Oh, we are human. But there is a new reality that has come to us through your gift. We have been given the new name. We have been called children of God. Even as the Christ of Bethlehem has pointed out the way to the ultimate reality for us, we pray now that as your children, somehow, in this world of deception, we may be able to point the way to the only one who is the way and the truth and the life through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.